neighbor. I was out in the backyard one day sanding. I was out there for hours sanding this little palm sander. And I stopped.
And you're like,
and it was still going. I'm like, I look up. And it's Brent's in the same neighborhood. I mean, it's wide open spaces. And I'm thinking, what the hell is a weed eater flying overhead? And here's this drone just staring at me at like 8 feet. Very ominous. And there's nobody there. And I thought, what the hell is going on here? And then my neighbor comes walking up through the field. I'm like, I've got to have that. He goes, you want to fly it? I'm like, no, I don't want to break it. He goes, you can't break this thing. And I'm like, all right.
There was a loss in the bourbon world this week. Master distiller emeritus for Heaven Hill, Parker Beam, passed away after his fight with ALS. Parker saw Heaven Hill through the golden age of the 60s, the decline of the 70s, and paved the way for today's new excitement. He was responsible for bringing out Heaven Hill's first premium small batch bourbon, Elijah Craig, in 1986, Evan Williams single barrels in 1994, and of course, Parker's Heritage Collection. Our prayers and condolences go out to his wife Linda, his family, and the entire Heaven Hill family. For this week's episode, we're returning back to the distilleries to hear the stories from the inside. There's more bonus content that didn't make it in this episode when we talk about drone racing, barbecuing, and more that you can only hear if you're a Patreon supporter. Patreon sponsorships start as little as $1 a month. So please, if you like what you hear, support the show. It really does go a long way in making this podcast great. Visit patreon.com. That's patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. Enjoy this week's episode. Welcome back to the episode of the Bourbon Pursuit Podcast. Kenny here, back again at Four Roses. We are doing our tour of Lawrenceburg. And you know what? I'm very, very happy to have Lennon Ferguson back on the podcast again today. So, Lennon,
hello.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Lennon, for anybody that doesn't know about you, quickly give us a recap of who you are and what you know about bourbon.
Hey, I'm Lennon Ferguson, live in Crestwood, Kentucky. Lived in Kentucky all my life. Been drinking bourbon, not all my life, but, you know, for the better part of, 15 years or so. And so I'm just happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, good. So, again, thank you and welcome to the show. And I know we're kind of under the gum today, so we are going to go ahead and just jump into it. So today we have Ryan Ashley. Ryan is the COO and the Director of Distillery Operations here at Four Roses. So, Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So one of the questions that we always start the show off with and kind of just try to give a gauge of just to see that you're not infallible, that you are human is, talk about your past. Like, where'd you grow up and, you know, how did you get into all this?
Okay. I'm originally from the Midwest. I grew up in Wisconsin. I was born just outside of Milwaukee and then moved to Green Bay in the second grade. Did most of my schooling in Green Bay. After high school, moved to Milwaukee, went to Marquette University. My grandfather was a brewer for Miller for 40 years. My other grandfather worked for Red Star Yeast. And of course, being in the Midwest, being in Milwaukee, hearing all these stories growing up about how they were bootleggers, and of course, just about everybody was a bootlegger or made their own beer, really got me interested in first making beer. And I didn't really have a taste for beer necessarily. I liked tinkering and I liked building and creating. So I got into brewing and the results were really good. And then I started to develop my palate for beer and brewing and ended up going on to school for brewing. I've studied all over the world. I've taught people from all over the world. But I did brewing from about 94 till about 2006. And it was at that time that I found the opportunity here at Four Roses and transitioned from brewing to distilling. And really, I went from the craft brewing segment, having my own craft breweries and helping other people design beers and build breweries around the world. I went to work for one of the big industrial light lager breweries out in Southern California to gain the other side of the experience. And decided that I really wanted to come back to my craft roots. And really, when this opportunity at Four Roses presented itself 10, 11 years ago, it seemed like the perfect opportunity because, again, I went from this huge complex to this beautiful historic site. I could get my arms around the entire process, and I was really involved in the process. You know, I could be the one making the changes and fine-tuning and really keeping the liquid flowing through the plant.
Because the odd thing is that pretty much
everything up until making bourbon is pretty much the same thing as making beer.
Yes, yes. The thing I was appalled at or shocked at when I came here was the difference in sanitation of a distillery and a brewery. Now, that's not special to Four Roses. That's any distillery. But, you know, the beer that you make in a brewery has got to stay fresh until it gets the day the consumer opens that. And you can't predict that. It can be riding around in the trunk of a car, sitting under fluorescent lights in a convenience store or whatever. So it has to have a pretty good shelf, a really good shelf life. The beer that we make here only lives to be 88 hours old from the time it's mashed to the time we distill it. And then, of course, you're distilling. It's alcohol. It's sterilized. I was in shock, but yeah, it's very, very similar to making beer with the added step now of concentrating those flavors through distillation. And then, of course, the aging process.
Because you were pretty much a pretty big beer guy before all this started, right? I mean, correct. I think I've read it before that you were totally into beer. Like you didn't know that bourbon was going to be your thing, but I mean, you thought beer was your world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Still is a big chunk of my world. It was nice. Brewing, I should say, really took over my life. My family was very accommodating to that, very understanding, but, you know, it was constant day in and day out. So kind of switching gears, and I brought beer back to be more of my hobby. I have a pretty nice little automated nano brewery at home, so I can brew for the neighborhood or, you know, whoever, myself. And this is nice because I get to do the same thing. I'm still crafting. I'm still making something. There's still the science. There's still the art. Of course, in distilling, we say there's also a little bit of voodoo, but it's, you know, I'm doing essentially what I want to do at just a different level. And I think the timing was perfect, too. You know, I got into brewing just before the brewing renaissance was really taking off, and coincidentally got into bourbon before bourbon really started to take off. So,
because both of those,
timing was key.
Both of those, the brewing industry, craft brewing, and bourbon is kind of like, it's kind of followed the same upward mobility.
Yep.
Oh, easily. So I guess, you know, one of the things that we want to talk about first off is talk about some of your job responsibilities around here, right? As a COO, as the, I don't know, what you call it yourself, the head of operations, kind of, what are some of your day-to-day responsibilities here at the distillery at Four Roses?
I think the main focus is, one, making sure that we operate as a team. We're a very small group. Everybody wears many different hats. So communication is key, keeping my finger on the pulse, but also giving my team autonomy to do their job. You know, I was afforded that throughout my entire career, so I really believe that's important. You know, people that are in this industry, specifically at Four Roses, are very passionate about what they do. I think you'd be hard-pressed to go through any of our employees and find somebody who's here because, oh, they love number crunching, or they, you know, or it's just a job. I mean, I would say 98 to 99% of our staff are here because they're passionate about bourbon, and not just any bourbon, our bourbon. So it's keeping my finger on the pulse, making sure that our team is happy and we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. You know, the nice thing is that bourbon is, you know, it's not new groundbreaking technology. We're essentially doing the same thing over and over and over every 3.5 hours, essentially. But what makes it, you know, more exciting and more unique with Four Roses is we do things very, very differently. We have the five yeast strains. We have the two different mash bills. So we're mashing, cooking, fermenting, distilling, and aging 10 distinctly different bourbons year round. So, you know, the day to day is monitoring that and making sure everyone's happy and everyone's working harmoniously and that the distillery's running at all times. I mean, we're at maximum capacity right now, so, you know, it's quality first, quantity second, but every moment counts. You know, as you see out in the plant, we're building at the same time that we're producing, and that's very tricky. So, you know, it's my job's gotten a little more complex as of recent because we're trying to produce, you know, as safely as possible, the highest quality distillate, and every drop of that counts right now, but also add double the capacity so we can continue that on when we marry the whole plant together when the expansion is complete.
So before, I want to talk about the expansion, but I also want to hear about a horror story.
Horror story.
Tell me a horror story. Like, tell me one time that you came into work and you're just like, shit just went. I mean, it just hit the wall.
It'll happen. Yeah, now that you say that, I will get a call at like 3 a.m. We have a very talented team. I mean, throughout the entire operation, they take complete ownership in what they do. We don't have management here on the off shifts or the weekends or even the holidays. We empower our people to make decisions. If they feel they need more support or they just don't want to pull the trigger on their own, they can call up the line and we're going to assist them. I can dial in from home and look at the automation in the system and help people with the programs. But God, an old shit moment. I think it was, I started in January, late January. And so it was our first shutdown. So I'd only been here 5 months. I think it was May, maybe June. And I was assistant director. My boss was director and COO. He was on vacation and I could not get a hold of him. And the gears that run the cooker that turn everything and make it moving, which is essential, otherwise it'll turn to basically jello and you're dead in the water, seized. And so here I am. Of course, it happens on a Friday and it's 3 p.m. and now I've got to make the call. You know, do we shut down and wait for a new one to come in? Do we pull the old one out and have it repaired? You know, what's the quickest answer? So I had to make a pretty high dollar decision on my own on the fly. And the result was we ordered a brand new one, got it in as quickly as possible, then took the one that was seized up out, had it refurbished, and it's sitting in the barn waiting for this expansion project to be used. But it's, you know, again, when you're producing quality product, but, you know, you're at maximum capacity, every moment counts. And so, you know, my job was to get it up and running as soon as possible. I'm sure there are other oh shit moments. I'm sure as soon as I drive out of here, I'll think of one. I can think of some oh shit moments in brewing that were pretty crazy, but I guess that's good. I mean, things are pretty even keeled here. It's brewing is a little more fast paced, whereas distillation is hurry up and wait. Mm-hmm. You know, you make the mash, you ferment it, you put it away, and then you wait 6, 8, 10 years. But thankfully, we haven't had very many, you know, what the hell are we going to do now moments.
Right.
You know, as one of my mentors told me many, many moons ago, you know, there are no problems, only solutions. I try as best as I can to keep that in mind. Sometimes those solutions are hard to find.
So I guess the big news is that Four Roses is investing $55 million into expanding operations. But we all know within remodeling projects with a budget 15%. So we're going to say $63 million is probably what it's going to be. So kind of talk about what's going to happen with that. Like what is going into $55 million slash whatever what's going to be built here at the property?
Well, a big chunk of that is warehouses. Believe it or not, warehouses are incredibly expensive. So we have money in there for a few warehouses going on at Cox's Creek. We also put in a 80,000 square foot bottling facility with what we call a high speed bottling line. I'm sure by most other distillery standards, it's a pretty quick, you know, bottling line. But what's going on here at the distillery is we're doubling everything. We're doubling the capacity. And we're doing that in such a way to maintain the quality and the integrity of the product. It would have been a lot cheaper to go out and pick a green field and build, you know, a second distillery, so to speak. However, then there's this perception you have two different distilleries and maybe they operate differently. Plus, again, this gets back to what I had mentioned before, the voodoo or the terroir, that microclimate that is in within the distillery, particularly fermentation. So what we're doing is we're really shoehorning all of that equipment into the existing facility. We're taking and adding, you know, doubling the yeast capacity, our mashing capacity, another cooker. We're adding another doubler, another beer still, all under the same roof.
Oh, wow.
So it's been a tremendous work of moving an elevator shaft 14 feet over to accommodate a cooker. So spending a lot of money that normally you'd say, that's ridiculous.
So
build another building. But it's it's to maintain that integrity. And just a moment, in fermentation is where it really matters because, again, we've been fermenting with these five yeast strains in this one building, you know, since, 1910. And that and the lactic bacteria that we use to get the sour mash, all those things live in that room. There's a microclimate in there. The brick, the wood, everything is impregnated with that. So to build another fermentation area separate from where we are, there's that, you know, could we make the same product? Yes, probably. Would it be the same quality? Yes, probably. However, it's not worth taking the chance. Again, with beer, you know, in 3 weeks, 6 weeks, you've got the result. You can tweak it. You've got the result again. Here, you make it, you put it to bed for 6, 8, 10 years. By the time you realize you're okay or there's a difference, well, it's too late. You have warehouses full of a possibly a different product. So in order to maintain that consistency, basically, you know, imagine fermentation as a room with four sides. We're going to blow three of those sides out and expand around that. Fill that space with the same mixture of wooden and stainless steel fermenters, primarily wood. They're open fermenters. And then allow the existing fermentation area to breathe and to migrate into that existing space. And then we will slowly start utilizing those fermenters to guarantee us, you know, that same microclimate. We're not changing it. Because again, I mentioned earlier, you know, I was appalled or shocked by the difference in sanitation. Well, that's where it's really key. You know, in a brewery, you would love to just spray chlorine all over the place and kill everything and make sure that you only have one yeast strain growing at a time. In the distillery, it's much different. If I were to go down there to our existing fermenter room and chlorinate that whole room, it would probably have a huge impact on the product after doing so.
Is it because of what is called like the sour mash process of just being able to have like partial of whatever was the last batch into the new batch? Or I mean, what is the
yes and no? Yes and no. That's kind of the voodoo again. You know, it's living because you say, well, wait a minute, you're putting one strain of yeast depending on what you're making, and you want that yeast to flourish. So we give it the best environment so that yeast flourishes. But yes, there is that carryover of the back set, the sour mash, the stillage. We're taking off the still that came from a previous fermenter and putting it in the next fermenter. You know, again, it's that kind of the voodoo of, well, no, we don't want stuff to fall off the walls into a fermenter. That's not part of it. It's just there is such a thing, I think, in distillation and fermentation. The way we do it is too clean. You know, if you start getting rid of those bugs that have lived, I say bugs, yeasts that have lived in that room for, you know, 100+ years, you run the risk of changing it. There's a neat story about a Belgian brewery just a few years back that they went into a building that had been sitting vacant for about 100 years. They were expanding their fermentation in huge closed barrels. But in order to kind of have the same terroir, they basically took their different products and sprayed the brick and sprayed the wood and let it grow to kind of simulate that.
Wow.
Yeah. So how do you, I mean, when you double expansion, double production, double everything, and you're not building a separate facility but putting them together, how in the world do you continue not only production but also you said you're, you know, you want to create the kind of same environment? I mean, is to manage that process and to continue to fulfill demand of the product that you make, how do you manage that whole process?
Very carefully. I mean, again, it's communication here is the key. Everyone here is a brand ambassador. I mean, every worker in the distillery knows what they're doing. They take a tremendous amount of pride in what they're doing. But, you know, essentially you can break down what we're doing is we're operating what I'll call the existing facility the way it is. We're duplicating everything. I mean, the cooker will be a mirror image of the new cooker will be a mirror image of the existing, the yeast room, everything. So we're not changing how we do it. We're not adding a bigger cooker and taller fermenters because, you know, the geometry of a fermenter has an impact. The volume, the hydrostatic pressure has an impact on the yeast. So we are keeping everything as much as possible identical to what we're doing now. And it costs a lot more money to do that, but
yeah, that was that tricky. Was actually a pretty good question by Michael Leeper on Facebook, and he says, and kind of tails on to that, it says like, how do you deal with the issues that you struggle with as you scale up distillation, because you've got things to meet such as grain, glass, packaging, and at the end of it, you've got labor as well. So yeah. how do you meet those expectations when you're adding on almost a second distillery onto this?
Yeah, well, we started this years ago, and you know, primarily with meeting with our suppliers and saying, hey, look, again, we're non-GMO corn. We're the only non-GMO bourbon distillery. are we going to be able to get that GMO, non-GMO corn? Yes. You know, are we going to be able to get the same quality rye? Yes. You know, is the same malt available? Yes. So all the raw materials are available to us. You know, things like copper and Vendome's time, because they're, you know, they're just as busy as we are. We had to order a lot of this stuff a year, 2 years out. So it's careful planning. There's, I don't think we're in danger of running out of any material, whether it's wood for fermenters or wood for barrels. Labor, yes, we're going to need more labor. We've hired some engineers we have now on staff that have been a tremendous addition to our team. We won't double our labor in the plant, but we will certainly be adding jobs. You know, there is going to be some economy to that scale. And packaging. Again, we're, of all the bourbon distilleries, we're the smallest. So we're not looking at the quantities, you know, a Jim Beam is looking at for obtaining material. But even in their case, I'm sure they're fine to get the materials they're getting. It's just managing it and, you know, really eating, breathing, and drinking it, so to speak. I mean, we really got to be thinking about it. It's the passion. You really have to be thinking about it at all times. And I think that's part of what passion is. It's not just coming to work, doing your job, and going home and forgetting about it. It's that sitting up at 11, you know, 11, I wish, sitting up at 3 a.m. going, oh, shit, we can do it this way, or we should do it this way, or we forgot about this.
It's, well, and that, I mean, you know, having managed people in my career, you're managing people in your career, you know, that's part of the job that they don't tell you about is like you're constantly, your brain is constantly going, thinking, how can we do this just a little bit better, train our people just a little bit better, mm-hmm. make this work just a little bit better, and help our company grow just a little bit better. So at the end of the day, you know, we're not only competing, but we're exceeding, you know, expectations of Kieran, mm-hmm. or our customers, or our retailers, or whoever's in the process.
Yeah, I think the good thing is that's been ingrained in our team for so long. You know, the being quality minded isn't new because we had new ownership in 2002. I mean, this is something that we've always strived for. It is a big challenge, but again, it's one of those things we all wanted, and it's exciting to see.
So I guess it kind of rolls into a good question because, you know, you're COO of all this, but I guess one thing to kind of ask is, how do you like working with Brent? Like, what is it like working with Brent in regards of what he wants to see and what you're outputting?
Brent and I have a tremendous relationship. I mean, when I first moved here, Brent, I think, was with the company just about a year. And, you know, we became quick friends. Like I said, we live in the same neighborhood. You know, our families, our friends, our kids have played. We do things together. So we have a great relationship. We have very common goals. There's really no headbutting. It's you know, we speak very freely. Again, I think what we have here, not Brent and I, but just Four Roses in general, is very unique, not just to the industry, but I think unique to most working situations where people are so comfortable and happy to come to work, and it's such a great thing to talk about. I mean, we had last year just, 68,000 people come through the distillery. You know, they came through the distillery, tucked in the woods here in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, and each and every one of them, they didn't stumble upon it. They, you know, this was a destination that they wanted to come to, they wanted to see, they wanted to talk to us. You know, like I said, Brent and I work very well together. We make ourselves very accessible to anyone on the team or anybody in the public. So it's a great relationship. I think the next step is, you know, again, Brent and I started about the same time. The one thing that we've always wanted to do a little bit more was create more, develop new products. You know, I'm sure people are going to start asking when you come.
Oh, let's go, let's go.
With a rye, you know, maybe a barley-based bourbon. You know, there's a lot of different things. And suffice it to say that both Brent and I are chomping at the bit to do that. You know, first and foremost, it's get the expansion complete. And then we will have some excess capacity, and we really do hope to look down that road and maybe do some new exciting experimentation.
Go ahead, humorous. What are you thinking?
There's a number of things. I don't want to say anything because somebody will take the ball and run with it. But again, we're very traditional. We're not going to be doing any flavored bourbons or any fly by night type of stuff. But they're a rye. I mean, we use the highest percentage of rye of any of the big bourbon distilleries out there, with our variety of yeast and our knowledge of the yeast and the rye and how it operates puts us in a very good position to do a much higher rye or a straight rye. Or a barley-based bourbon, or one of the things I see when you look at innovation in distillation, and particularly in a bourbon distillery, is aging bourbon in different types of casks. Now, you can't call it bourbon; it's bourbon aged in XYZ cask. But I think that's kind of the next thing that you're going to see. Not from Four Roses necessarily, but I think from all bourbon distilleries is aging in different casks to give a variety. And it's very, very popular with scotch. I wouldn't be surprised if you see a lot more of that with bourbon.
Oh, sorry. I'm going to finish up with two questions for you. So one of them is, so you are a big brewer and you got your history in brewing. So kind of talk about, we always talk about there's pretty much a lot of similarities between brewing and distillation, but what are the differences? Like, what are the stark differences between being a brewer and being a distiller?
Well, in terms of the process, the mashing sequence is very different. You're starting at a low temperature in brewing, and depending on whether you're infusing or you're heating directly, you're raising that temperature. In distillation cooking, you're starting at the high end of the temperature because of the corn, and then you're working your way down and adding different grains at different temperatures because of the enzymes and their sensitivity. Again, sanitation is a big one. The beer only has to be 88 hours old, or let's say 3.5-4 days old. So as long as you give it a good healthy population of yeast and you did your mashing cooking correctly, you're going to have a really good stable product. But if you don't keep that machine running constantly and that beer starts to get older in age, it starts to change and you start to have quality issues. Again, there's no instant reaction. In a brewery, you can play around on a small scale. You can get a result in 3 weeks, 6 weeks, and say, maybe we need to tweak it a little bit, or we'll call it this, or we'll make it into that. Again, in the distillery, once you make it, if it doesn't meet our standard, we either sell it off to someone and it gets turned into hand sanitizer or redistilled for a gas additive or expensive vodka. There is no second chance. So you have to make that distillate right the first time. And then it goes into a barrel, again, an all-natural product, and it's got to age. So there's that hurry up and wait. I mean, and again, our minimum age is 6 years. And so you're waiting a tremendous long time and putting a lot of faith in what you've done and what Mother Nature is going to do to get that product out there. So, beer is very diverse. Bourbon's very diverse. Beer is just a lot quicker turnaround and results, so you can tweak things and fine-tune things a lot quicker than you can bourbon.
You a stout guy or a hops guy?
I drink all styles of beer. I think, every beer has its place. I studied in Germany. My specialty was Hefeweizen, Bavarian wheat beer. But right now, if you were to open up my beer fridge, I've got a lot of IPAs and a lot of Belgian beers.
Good deal. So if we had to close this out and we had to say, what was the best beer you had in 2016 or the past year? What's it going to be? Because, I'm a stout guy.
Yeah.
It's not a bourbon, but it's goddamn, it's probably the closest thing I'm going to get to a bourbon, yeah, right? Like, yeah. if I can stick a fork in it or stick a knife in it and it sticks, like, that's like, I want a big, thick, heavy stout. Well, that's what I like.
And so I need to have you guys over to the house sometime. And I've been talking to Brent about this. I've got just a massive collection of bourbon, rum, and beer. And primarily the beer is comprised of Russian Imperial stouts, barley wines, milk stouts. They're all these big bombers. And a lot of them are just, friends that are brewers will send them from their breweries, or people that have aged in our barrels will send us these stouts. So I do love stouts, but there's only so much Russian Imperial stout I can drink. And it's tough to come home and open a 750 and go, I'm going to drink a 750 of 11% beer right now. I can do it. I do it, but I can't do it every day.
I would say a good perk to that is the fact that I'm going to give you a barrel you just make sure you send me a 750 back.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, but working in beer and in bourbon, you know, there's no shortage of when I go to a bar and if I've got to pay just a crazy price for a drink, you know, I think back to, you know, decades of never paying for a drink and all this free stuff I have at home. But not to skirt around your question. I mean, the best beer I've had, I mean, it depends on the moment. It depends on the activity. Depends what's going on. But, you know, if I had to pick some favorite beers, I go to the Belgian styles. Orval is probably one of my favorites. Duvel, I really enjoy. I'm trying to think of a really good beer. I've had some really good barrel-aged beers recently from Firestone Walker. Brooklyn has sent me some. Garrett Oliver has sent me a bunch of his ghost beers that you can't get.
Yeah, I had a Speedway Stout a few weeks ago, and I thought it was pretty impressive. So
yeah. So it changes. I mean, you know, the best beer is the one I've got in my hand, I guess. That's
I know, right? Awesome. Well, you know what, Ryan? I want to say thank you for coming on the show today. This is fantastic. We learned a lot more just about Four Roses and the operations that goes into it and what's coming to what we're going to see. So, I mean, Lyndon, what did you think?
Great stuff. Appreciate meeting you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Anytime.
Yeah. So if you like what you hear, make sure you support us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook at Bourbon Pursuit. And if you have any more show suggestions or people would like to see, make sure you send us an email. That's the duo, theduo at bourbonpursuit.com. Thank you again. And we'll see you all next week.
This podcast of Bourbon Pursuit is in partnership with thewhiskeywash.com, a lifestyle website for news and reviews for people who like whiskey, and for those who think a life without whiskey has no style, thewhiskeywash.com.